Start now? Okay. Hi, this is the Retro Computing panel, and we will be talking about retro computing. We have a few panelists, so I'm going to give a very brief presentation on the TRS-80 color computer, so 2 minutes maybe, so I can have more time for other people. Sam Nitzberg has bachelor's and master's degrees in computer sciences and is presently pursuing his PhD in computer science. He has worked for 10 years in the software engineering and security fields with multiple national and international publications and presentation matters related to computing, security, and ethics. He may be contacted at sam@imsam.com, and his website is www.imsam.com. He will be speaking about the Apple II and the interesting things you can do with an Ovation Apple Cat. The Night Stalker was born in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1951 and currently lives in Boston. He's been part of CDC for over 10 years and a Commodore user since 1985. He'll be talking about the C64 and why it's God's gift to humanity. Graphics is some kid I met in an IRC room and said, he'd bring some stuff, so I guess I just allowed him to speak. And he's going to be talking about the legacy that these systems have today. I am Mr. Om, known to most people as Mr., and that's it, so... Night Stalker.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Well, where to begin? I decided to start with the Commodore 64 because it was damn cheap. The Apple at the time was retailing for, if I recall correctly, in excess of $1,000, whereas the Commodore was in the $400 range. If you bought it brand new, I bought my system used for about $300. It had a Commodore 64, a monitor, and a disk drive. Also came with a printer interface and the data cassette drive. Today, I still use a Commodore system. I have Commodore 128, which has been heavily tricked out and hardware hacked to hell and gone. And the only bits that remain of my original system are the data cassette drive and the printer interface. Everything else has changed. The 64 was, in many respects, an entry computer for a lot of people, in that, again, it was inexpensive, and surprisingly powerful for what it could do. You would think that, you know, this day and age, a machine that runs at 1 megahertz and has a whopping 64 kilobytes of memory, you know, that's a keyboard buffer. But... through clever programming and literally getting down there and hammering on the bare silicon with assembly language, 64 and later the 128 could do things that astonish people even today. For example, there's text editors. A little text editor, if it's well written and well crafted and good tight code, can do virtual anything that earlier versions of Word Perfect could do. But you don't need a whacking big MS-DOS machine or Macintosh to do it in. Now, I know of several PhD dissertations that were written on a Commodore 64. Now, it's the only thing that counts is what it looks like on paper, not how you do it. I mean, in the good old days, we had a good-natured snobbery amongst us computer users. You know, the Commodore 64 people would bash the Apple people would bash the Atari people, and everyone would dump on IBM. So today, people ask, okay, well, what the hell can you do with these things? They're doorstops. They're boat anchors. Again, with clever programming and a few little hardware additions, getting on the Internet is not a problem, even at high speeds, even with a 56K modem. There is a marvelous company in Massachusetts called CMD Devices. Website is www.cmdweb.com, I believe, but a web search will find it for you. And they produce a variety of hardware and firmware accessories for the Commodore. They have a gadget. It's called the Turbo 232 interface. It's a little cartridge. Let's see. Can you get this out? Not much bigger than this 1200 baud modem. And it plugs into the expansion port on the back of the computer here. One unfortunate thing about the Commodore was there were wires everywhere. So you have to bear with me. So this thing is a cartridge port, or expansion port. Most people use it for game cartridges and whatnot, but this is a bus. This goes directly into the system bus. And with the Turbo 232 cartridge, rather, which is, I believe, an ACIA adapter, you can have the Commodore 64 sucking in and squirting out data at upwards of, I think, 200 kilobits per second, which is, you know, pretty darn good. Which means, you know, 56K modem is trivial. Other things that CMD produces, well, hard drive for the Commodore 64. Yeah. What they do is they have an interface. It's in a box, which turns, well, it's basically, it's a translating interface. The serial data that comes out of the Commodore serial port to this big old clunky disk drive goes in this little converter and comes out as parallel SCSI. Parallel SCSI comes in as serial for the Commodore. And the Commodore doesn't notice a damn thing. It just thinks it's a really big floppy drive. So they started out with 20 megabyte hard drives, and now I imagine you can put as, you know, whatever the largest SCSI drive is today, you could put into this thing, and the Commodore would just sit there and happily use it. Another thing. There's some disadvantages to the Commodore. One was atrociously slow disk access, I.O. I mean, this thing doesn't read or write. It uploads and downloads to the disk drive at 300 baud. Yeah. So after the very first thing that 90% of the Commodore users bought after they got their Commodore 64 was the Epix Fastload cartridge. This did some little software jiggery-pokery and speeded up disk I.O. pretty good. It also had a built-in machine language monitor. And you know, giving a monitor to some people is like giving whiskey and car keys to teenage boys. And from there, we came into what was called the demo scene with the Commodore. I have something here called the VIC chip, the video interface chip. A programmable device of amazing depth and breadth that if you know how to do it, you can do things that will astonish people. The Commodore has a screen resolution of 320 by 200 pixels in high-res mode, which means you can have a background color and a foreground color. That's it. Usually black on white. In medium-res mode, it is 160 by 200. What that means is the horizontal resolution of each pixel is doubled because you had to get around certain limitations. Remember, back in the good old days, RAM was expensive. I'm going to divert for a moment. Back in the mid-70s, 8K of RAM, if I recall correctly, would cost you approximately $2,000 and would come on a card. It was about yay big. It would plug into a big old expansion cage. Now, try and find an 8-kilobyte chip. You know, so RAM was expensive, so you had to do all sorts of clever tricks to get around it. And the VIC chip was a pretty clever device. You know, it did what it was supposed to do. But once you got people who were interested in programming and interested in finding out as much as you could do with this thing, they were getting this thing to jump through hoops that were never intended to be jumped through. Know the story. Commodore used to have what they called the World of Commodore Expos in Westchester, Pennsylvania, where they're headquartered. And people would come from all over the world and set up their computers, you know, to sell things, to demonstrate whatever. So there was a demo writing crew from Europe there. They had a demo going on, and the screen was doing stuff like you wouldn't believe. You know, you see the blue borders. Theoretically, nothing can go there. Well, you know, a good demoer can put anything there. They make the screen expand and just, you know, text scrolling on all four sides. It's amazing things. So an older gentleman is looking at this, and he's looking at it, he's peering at it. Okay, he's looking at the computer. And he finally asks, okay, how did you modify the Commodore to do that? And the guy said, oh, no, we didn't do it all. It's all software. No, my guy, you can tell me. No, just between us guys. How did you hack the Commodore? No, it's all software. We're all just screwing with the VIC chip. And he says, well, you know, I designed the VIC chip. It can't do that. So So they apparently said, wow, great. You know, it's like meeting, you know, Steve Wozniak somewhere. One of the heroes of the computer revolution. And, they showed him the code and everything. They're pointing out to the guy that designed the VIC chip how they made his baby do things. It's amazing. So, today, I mean, there are people that get on the Internet with a Commodore 64 or 128 and think nothing of it. It's not that difficult from a hardware or software standpoint. The hard part is just finding an ISP that will give you a dial-up shell account. Everyone wants to go, TCP IP. What are you going to do? Well, right now there are experimental TCP IP stacks that work on the Commodore 64. They do take up a lot of room. There's not a whole lot of space left over. But it is being worked on. And I will prophesize that within 2 or 3 years, there will be a TCP ICP application for the 64 and the 128 that will let you do virtually everything that mainstream computer can do today. With perhaps the exception of graphics, you've got 16 colors on this thing, which was considered pretty good back in the day. With the VIC chip again, you get into that, and you can do things. You can do page flipping. You can do raster interrupts. You can get 32,000 colors on a Commodore 64 screen. If you don't mind scrolling it back and forth, you can get large images on a Commodore screen in that little 320 by 200 space. If you don't mind hardware hacking your Commodore 128 and putting in a second SID chip for sound interface device, with a little software, you can play MP3s. Of course, you need to have the hard drive to do that. It's damn hard to put, an MP3 on a little floppy disk that has, you forget how much. Forget how much is on these now. It's been so long. It's not a whole lot. Yeah. And other things that were done with the Commodore were clever, stupid disk tricks. You could do things with that. There was one marvelous little gimmick. Because the Commodore disk drive, this big, clunky, beige box, the built-in power supply, is an intelligent peripheral. It has a 6510 processor in it. In other words, it's at least as smart as an Apple. No offense intended. So, and it has 2K of RAM in it. So you can program the Commodore 64. Rather, the Commodore 1541 disk drive. I was going to bring a program with me, but I had such a weird day Thursday getting down here. I left my disks at home, and I really regret it. There's a program, if anyone has a Commodore 64 and can find it, it's called 1541 Music Machine. And what this... I'd love to meet the guy that programmed this. He must have been on crack or something. What it does, it turns the Commodore 1541 disk drive into a sound synthesizing device by doing what I would assume to be terrible things to the motor that moves the read-write head back and forth. The thing plays Bicycle Built for Two. And it's I swear, I'm not making this up. I'm not on drugs. This is true. There's another stupid disk drive trick, again, programming it. We have a little red light on the front here, which is your power indicates, things turned on and off. What you can do is you can have the power on light slowly fade off and on, off and on. And you'd run this on someone as a prank and say, oh my, I think your drive's broken, man. And they'd freak out. So that was just a trick, the disk drive. Uploading and downloading a 300 baud. What the heck is that about? Well, because it had to be compatible with the VIC-20, which was designed around a tape drive. Now, the I.O. routines in the computer are not that bright, and it was intended to be used for a cassette deck, because disk drives, good God, these things cost over $600 when they were new. Who pays $600 for a floppy drive these days? So there were clever software tricks for this to increase I/O speed. And these good folks at CMD decided, well, that's kind of stupid. We'll do better. And they have something called Jiffy DOS, which is a ROM replacement set, which speeds up disk I/O by, I think, 15 times, which is pretty darn good. And it also gives you other things. You can, simple two-keyboard command. You can print a file to the screen, much like the type command in MS-DOS. You can direct it to the printer. You have what's called a wedge. That is simply a little bit of software that wedges itself into the OS that allows you to do really simplified keyboard commands. Now, for example, if I wanted to do something with the drive, be open 15, comma 15, no, open 15, comma 8, 15, colon, command to initialize the disk, I, close 15, return. You know, that's like MS-DOS, for God's sakes. Whereas with a wedge, it's like, at I, return, and your disk is just drive is initialized, which made life a lot easier for people. Let's see, what else about the Commodore, which is of interest? As I said, it can be used as on the Internet. I mean, the people doing it today, which has kind of sparked a resurgence in Unix, learning Unix amongst people. You know, people would buy their Commodores and, you know, learn all the ins and outs of the Commodore and then want to get online and then discover, oh, God, I have to learn this Unix thing. And then discover, well, Unix isn't that difficult. It's kind of fun, actually. Go ahead and do all the stuff on a host computer. What else can I do with Unix? Gee, what's this Linux I hear about? And they wind up getting a 486 box, and they wind up learning Linux. And, you know, another customer lost for Microsoft. Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I know people that started out with 64, went online, learned Unix, learned Linux, and discovered that, hey, I can make money with this. And they're now administrating Unix machines and Linux networks for huge amounts of money, but they still go home to their Commodores because that's the machine they learn, that's the machine they know. I use a Commodore 128. That's my main computer. I have a Mac 2SI, which is solely for Internet access. I have, you know, all my games are on the Commodore, and I think that they're a lot better than what we have today on, you know, the Pentium 3s and the Big Macs. You know, Doom and Quake and that's all very nice, you know, really cool graphics, but it's basically, you know, point and kill. You know, when is the last time you know, some company released, you know, Adventure or Zork? If you want fast twitch, you know, fast muscle twitch games, they're all out there. But a game where you have to sit there and, you know, you stare at the screen and think, okay, now what does this mean? And you try something, and eventually you get it. And that's a lot more satisfying than, you know, killing the monsters, you know, taking their guns, because it makes you think, and that's a good thing. You know, not that blowing away a shitload of monsters in Quake isn't fun. You know, there are times when you just got to kill stuff, and that's good. So I said, there are my games around that. I have a lot of adventure games, a lot of thinking games. I do have a couple of shoot 'em ups, and there is a Doom clone for the Commodore. It's called Mood. Yeah, the graphics are really primitive, given limitations. But I've seen it. I fooled around with it, and as a Doom clone running on a 1 megahertz machine with 64K of memory, it ain't bad. My text editor is something called BB Writer. This is written by one guy that lives in Arizona, and coupled with a good printer, I use a Panasonic 24-print printer. My output is just as good as anything that comes off a laser printer, and that's all that matters. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of printer it is, as long as it looks good. That's what gets the point across. So you don't need a Pentium 3 or a G4 or a laser printer to have your stationery, your correspondence come across looking well. Which leads me to another thing. These things, a used Commodore system is incredibly cheap. You can pick them up at the MIT flea market in Massachusetts. You know, what I've got sitting in front of me, $25. know, computer, a monitor, and a disk drive. And what I do occasionally when I have the money and can do it, or if someone needs the help, I help people and organizations set up things using a Commodore. You know, they can't afford you. We have in Boston. We have a lot. For some reason, we have a lot of Haitians in Boston. Now, you think Haitians want to live someplace warm most of the year? In Boston, we get snow up to our armpits sometimes, but that's the way it is. So a lot of these folks are just dirt poor, and the organizations that try to help them are dirt poor. And they think, you know, well, we can't afford a computer. We'd rather spend the money to help our people. So you show up in one of these places with a monitor, computer, drive, and a printer, and a couple of disks of software. You've got a freeware text editor, a freeware mailing list program, freeware, you know, print shop. And suddenly, here's this poor group that can send out letters. They have a mailing list. They can print up flyers. They can do newsletters. And they can do them in Haitian, which has a lot of diacritical marks based on French, because the Commodore 64, you can load in new character sets. You're not limited to what's built into the ROM. So, yes, you can have custom character sets with all those little French diacritical marks that people that speak Haitian Creole can read. And suddenly, it's no longer a person-to-person. You know, one person has to tell one person to tell one person. They can mail out stuff to their fellow Haitians or their fellow Jamaicans or their fellow Ukrainians or their fellow Russians, whatever. And this puts them on an equal footing with any of the larger organizations because, you know, the data doesn't care what it's on. The only thing that's important is how you get it on paper and how you get it on the net and how you get it to people. And you can do all of that with a Commodore 64. I mean, these things will be running until there are no more parts available. You know, when the last Commodore has been cannibalized to fix the last working Commodore, that'll be it, and that'll be sometime well into the next century. And I'm sure the same thing could be said of the Apple or the Atari. And we have an Apple person right here who I would like to take over because I've got nothing more to say on the subject. Thank you.
Okay, you can hear me good? Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Apple in general, and most particularly my experiences with the Apple II model. In 1976, the first Apple I kits were made available, basically hand-built machines by, of course, Wozniak and Jobs. The first batch, only 50 were produced, and I understand that the total number is only in the few hundreds. The Apple II and II Plus were mass-produced and are technically going to be a little more interesting. The wide sales of the Apple II really took their stride in 1978, in the same year, I believe, as the TRS-80 peaked in its sales. That's also when the VisiCalc spreadsheet program came out. Of 130,000 Apple II sold, by September of 1980, 25,000 specifically were running VisiCalc. So sales were actually helped by business apps. After the Apple II, the Apple III emerged. Let's just say that didn't fulfill its promise. Yes, back then you heard the same laughter when people saw it and saw the price relative to what you got you from the Apple II, as you just heard a moment ago. It had weak sales. The Apple IIc came out later. I don't know offhand. I was thinking of making notes on the Lisa, but I didn't consider it very noteworthy. To me, it was an uninteresting machine, personally.
It was a horrible failure.
You just...
It's named after his illegitimate child.
Yeah. it really... The Lisa really died a bad death, and I'm not sure it had a very enlightened birth either. Okay, anyway, I'm going to move right along now. The Apple IIc was portable, had more memory, more capabilities, came out briefly after the Apple IIe, where they hyped up the II Plus, kind of like a II on steroids. Gave you certain things you needed, like 80 columns you could do, slightly nicer word processing, a little more memory. So 64K max of the card, you got up to 128K. So you can work with, quote-unquote, more data. Now, one thing I see very interesting in the Apple II series was that you had a very interesting foreshadowing of the IBM PC hardware interrupt request problem that's only been kind of recently solved with the whole USB port situation. And that you had 7 slots in your Apple II card. You had 48K of your base RAM, generally speaking. Well, you put in a memory card and slot 0. You put in your printer controller card. You added your disk drive card, or if you copy disks a whole lot, multiple drive controller cards, because you only got 2 drives on a controller. You had a serial card and a modem card. And you had your 80-column card. Well, you're down now to about 2 slots remaining, and you haven't done anything except give yourself some nice normal capabilities. Now, let's say you want slightly faster processing. Well, the 6502 processor was the basis for everything for the Apple. That was the heart of it. And we had really was a whole lot of logic chips around it, low-power Scott key devices, 74LS series chips, or 74L00 chips. Very simple, very easy to work with. You know what? Chip goes bad, you pop it, you put in another chip. Well, if you're not sure which chip it is, well, you place a couple of chips. It's no big deal. It cost about 50 cents at the time, maybe $2, most chips. It was nice. I'll mention, I don't recommend anyone do this, it was a cute little gimmick. Apple drives had great warranties, 1 or 2 years. Well, what happened is, what if you had 5 drives and 1 broke? Well, the warranty information stuck on a sticker on the back, everyone swapped out the case, you have eternal warranties. It was kind of nice. I wouldn't recommend doing such a thing, and they probably went on under the warranty now, but it was done quite a bit. Beautiful service policy. Now, you do a call negative 151, it drops you right into a little assembler where you can put in machine code instructions. You want to put in a machine program at memory address 0300 in hex, you type in 0300 colon, and you give it a stream of hexadecimal numbers, and it goes in as machine language code. Mm-hmm. The Apple II itself, not the Plus, actually had a built-in mini assembler as well. You went call negative 151, gave the address of the mini assembler F666G, and it did the G. It goes. It invokes the mini assembler. And it really encouraged you to play with the system in that regard. You've got an assembler, mini assembler, machine code access, all built in. You don't like the way it does something? Again, a lot of the environment was in ROMs, but you don't have to go out and get fancy assemblers, assembler toolkits, things that take multiple disks to load. You could also, if you wrote in BASIC and took too long, get compiled BASICs. So if running interpreted, we'll compile for you and put out executable code. You also have some fun languages like Forth and others where you have Turtle Graphics, which I never really used and get into too much, experimented briefly, but it was good because you thought of other paradigms for computing even then. It encouraged you to think about how you can represent things, not that you have to view it in one method. I believe they also had similar languages and environments for Commodore.
Oh, yes, yes.
Alternate operating systems. You want to do Pascal? You get University of California, San Diego, Pascal. It came with its OS environment. Fortran is based on the same environment, too. For business purposes, people would get a CPM80 card. You could run CPM80 beautifully on your Apple.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that took, of course, another expansion slot. Same problem you have with the IBMs. Now, there was really open computing, I think, the foreshadowing of modern open computing thought may have derived around this time period. But the scene's changed. You see, I've got a card here dated copyright 1981. That has a Z88 chip. I think that's a good 1 megahertz chip, significantly faster than 6502.
Right.
And it has a whole lot of little LS series logic chips in here. Very simple logic chips, just gates. And it has a nice little pinout. What's interesting is who wants you to run CPM80 on your Apple? Who is this leader? This monolith who thought it would be great to run multiple environments on a computer. Well, this product is the Microsoft Consumer Products Soft Card. Things have changed.
Dad, show them, so you can see the logo. That's the old Microsoft logo.
If anyone can do it later, we can see a close up.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, there's EDA chips, B chips.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, to me, the most interesting thing that went on was what were the security issues with the Apple? Because you could do a lot of neat little security things. Now, like other machines at the time, you had no password protection in BIOS, but that's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You can lock your door, it gets you the same effect.
Exactly.
No big deal. Now, again, it was a great machine to play with. For example, there was a game called Castle Wolfenstein. You went around shooting the bad guys, basically. Yeah, that was fun. Now, you could hack that. Now, I'm not even going to mention Castle Smurfenstein, where all the bad guys are replaced with Smurfs. And it started too with that damned music. Now, they were driving at the time. Now, you could put in a little read-write toggle switch on your drive, and you could toggle the write-enable write-protect sensor.
Mm-hmm.
Some drives, I believe one was by Rana Systems, you pushed a button and write-enable and protect was invoked and overridden. But what I found is if you go into a room in Castle Wolfenstein, you pop the disk open, it never writes that you died.
Mm-hmm.
So you get killed, you don't go all the way back to the beginning of the whole game, you don't reboot your system. Well, you might reboot the thing, but you come back and you're right where you entered that room. So we have a two-player version of Castle Wolfenstein. One guy mans the disk drive door hinge, and the other guy plays. Because you can't just overwrite it the whole time. You can't keep the disk closed the whole time because it won't do certain things it has to do and mess up your whole game. Now, we had soft sector disks, which made for other games. See, old disk, a lot of the CPM systems, a lot of your 8-inch disk systems, you had a little hole in the disk, and we still have holes in the disks, but a little LED showing a light through, and they're not necessarily always used to presently, but an LED would shine through, and essentially would let it know that's when the moment the hole was passing through, and it could tell what track and sector, or rather which, I believe, track you were looking at, which track. It identified you were going past, I believe, track zero every time it got that little ping. Well, hard sector disks, it knows where it is, and it can use timing and other tricks. Soft sector disks, you don't do that. You put in address headers, other pieces of information to let you know what you're looking at. Well, what this led to was copy protection schemes. CFM80 didn't really have them, except the ones using dongles, and they're not interesting. Now, what we could do is a company like Atari, with their Atari Soft product, I believe, could change the address headers. If your copy software is looking for D5AA, I'm going to say 96, but it's D5AAAB, your copy software won't know what it's copying. So we have track editors, and you could open up the file, look at the tracks and see, well, what are they using as headers? What are they using as other important parametric information? And this encouraged you, well, I'm using the word encouraged, to think about the environment, what it takes to copy things. You could use track editors. Look at the information, tell it what you wanted, and how to change parameters to copy. You could single-step the drive motor, or half-step it. So you could write in uneven patterns through the disk and set the tracks wherever you wanted. You could write off beyond what should have been the logical end of the disk based on how it was defined. And this led to a lot of opportunities to really play. At some point, though, all this got made into parameters for copy software, and you just put it in and told it what program you had.
Mm-hmm.
But for a while, you could really learn a lot by figuring out how to copy disks. It could be an introduction to code breaking, to protocols analysis. It would give great opportunities to think. I'm going to go about another 5 minutes. Another five?
Three?
I'll do what I can. Okay. Now, the AppleCAP modem was produced by Novation. I think it was one of the most interesting products ever produced. It allowed you at the time to hook up your AppleCAP modem to your machine with a little ROM chip. It could understand touch tone codes. There was software commonly available that would produce very many interesting tones. I believe it would produce cell phone codes. You have your 1 through 9, you have your pound, your 0, your star.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it also produced tones A through E.
Mm-hmm.
You want to start routing things? They're there.
There's other codes, too.
Now, you could also produce different tones with that. A built-in programmable D to A converter. You can make almost any tone you wanted. You could produce 2600 hertz tones. Pardon? MF, DTMF. Yes, mm-hmm. It did those. You could produce all kinds of tones. You could also produce quarter tones, nickel tones, dime tones. And I saw very recently in 2600 magazine an article on how to turn your home phone into a payphone.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to confuse your friends at your local telephone company, turn your home phone into a payphone and then give a feed of quarter tones.
Mm-hmm.
It also could produce, as I said, a 2600 tone. I took the liberty of bringing in a Captain Crunch whistle if anyone here wants to hear what it would sound like. Okay, I'm going to block a hole. I'm going to presume it's the right one, but I'll do both just to make sure I hit. And it's got the doggy on one side and a little Captain Crunch on the other.
And you're now under arrest for possessing a mischievous device.
Okay. Anyway, I'll conclude rapidly. I saw the Apple II as being a very interesting machine to learn from, and it had provided a wonderful basis to have a respect and understanding for fundamental security issues. But it was also just a great machine for playing with the available contemporary technologies at the time and see what you could really do with logic chips and a simple processor. Thank you.
Yeah, just real quick, I'd like to say that virtually everything he said about the Apple II also applied to the Commodore. They're essentially cousins. So it wasn't so much, you know, an angry rivalry, as more like a family feud between Apples and Commodore users.
Yeah, I'll just mention that. All the people I knew had Apples and Commodores always disparaged each other's choice in computers, but at the end of the day, they sat down, had sodas, talked about computers, and were good friends.
Yeah, really.
Bart, want to take a shot?
Snap the picture.
Kind of running out of time here, so I'm going to make my Coco speech even shorter than it was. And we're going to go on to graphics and speech. And then we're going to have a very brief question and answer. And then we're going to, if we have time, we're going to auction off an IBM workstation and a Coco 2.
Whoa.
So hopefully we'll have enough time for that. Okay, so I'm going to be talking very briefly about the TRS-80 Coco.
Take your time.
If you're wondering why this kid is up here talking about computers that were made 5 years before he was born, the answer is I was always interested in computers when I was very small. And the type of computers that I'm talking about here were the computers that were around then. So I just became very interested in finding out what was around before me and around when I was born. So, in the process of kind of having that history lesson, I became very interested in these computers. Because there's a lot of things that are missing from newer computer systems that they have. So, I'm going to shut up now and start talking about this. I found my Coco at a store for $20. I had no idea what the hell it was. And I had $20 and I wanted to buy an old computer. And it was a lot cheaper than the Atari 800 they were selling, so I bought it. I didn't really know what I was buying, but I'm glad I bought it, because I got a much more unique system. I'm going to go down a little to the history of the Coco. As many of you know, in 1977, Tandy Corporation released the TRS-80, which was their bid in the microcomputer market, and there's the one fan way over there. This was lovingly called Trash 80 for many reasons, and it was the third of the first three consumer-ready home computers. Unfortunately, or fortunately, the Apple II defeated it in the market in 1978. Actually, pretty much in late 1977. That same year, Tandy began talks with Motorola to create a very inexpensive home computer. And nothing really came of that at first, but Tandy was invited to make the computers for an agricultural project, which was codenamed Project Green Thumb. It was meant to give data to farmers through terminals. At the end of Project Green Thumb, Motorola was ready to make a processor that could be used in an inexpensive home computer that could be plugged into one's television. So, 3 years after the TRS-80, the first Coco was released. This is actually Coco 2. It came in this silver box with this chiclet-like keyboard. It's very awkward looking. And it originally came with 4K RAM and 8K ROM with BASIC. And it was, yeah, it was like that big. And it had medium success. The Coco 1 couldn't do very much, but even with those humble beginnings of that Coco, a lot of amazing things were created. The heart of the little Coco was a Motorola chip, the 6809E. And it was quite remarkable at the time, because when most chips could only do 8-bit processes, it could do several 16-bit processes, which was unheard of for small computers of the time. another thing, it was quite small for microprocessors at times. If I had a screwdriver, I could open it up and show you.
I got one.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating CPU. It was light years ahead of Motorola's 6502. Yeah. Really stabbed me there. That came in the Apple. But it never became quite as popular as the Apple II. A few years later, the Cocoa 2 was released, which is this, which was slightly smaller, came with a better keyboard, what was basically the same. Real revolution didn't come until 1986. I'm going to open this up later. That's when the Cocoa 3 was released. That was a really remarkable machine because it had a processor, well, another chip that took strain off the processor by rendering the graphics. So basically, you had a processor free to do many things, and it wasn't held down by the graphics. I think the thing that makes the Cocoa 3 very, very remarkable is the fact that it was one of the first multitasking home computers. You could buy an operating system called OS 9. It came with a GUI that was kind of like Windows, I suppose, more like Amiga DOS, but you could run multiple Windows at a time. And I'd like you to note that early incarnations of OS 9 came out at least 2 or 3 years before Windows and Mac OS, because they were being used in small quantities on Cocoa 1 and 2s. So, basically, this kind of technology, they weren't the first to use this kind of technology. I think Cocoa must have stole it from Xerox as well. So, the Cocoa 3, instead of being plugged into a TV, it can be plugged into an RGB monitor. Though it could still be plugged into a TV, so it was slightly more popular. It came with 512K, but it could be... Oh, no, excuse me. It came with 128K. It could be upgraded to 512K. And some companies even offered upgrades up to 2 megabytes. Let's see. It also offered graphics resolution of 640 by 255. And it was actually could do that, you know, that bouncing ball demo?
Oh, yes.
Superior to that of the Amiga. It could do it at much higher resolutions. In fact, it outperforms the Amiga in a lot of things, even though the Amiga is considered the first multimedia platform. I don't agree. I think the Cocoa 3 was. Another fascinating thing about it was a great BBS machine. You could run with a Cocoa 3... On an OS 9, with OS 9, you could run a BBS with 2 lines to get 3 callers, 2 through the phone lines, one local, and the SysOp could still run tasks at the same time, even if the people on the BBS were accessing files and things like that. So you could run a lot on that little machine. Yeah. So I personally have a 486 at home, and I find that my Motorola, which is something at 1.987 megahertz or something like that, is smoother and faster, taking the same workload proportionally. Because when you type on this, you can type and get no delay. But when you type on a 486 or 386 or something like that, there's something sticky about it, and that's why I really hate those chips. And I think, unfortunately, the Motorola chip was more expensive. The Cocoa did not get very popular. It's kind of a forgotten revolution. That I think if the Cocoa had been used, had become more popular, I think we'd have a much different computing world. I think there'd be more understanding of technology. Because, I mean, think of it. A home computer you can have and hook up to your TV has a Unix-based operating system. Imagine what that would be like today if everything was running like that. I think the environment of technology would be slightly different, more open and things like that. Yes. So I'm going to cut that very short and go on to graphics.
Okay, since we are short on time, I'm also just going to pretty much summarize mine. Acquiring the machines, most time, as we've already said, you can find them fairly cheap. Most of my machines, I usually acquire for free. My Apple II and my Apple II GSs, I got them from my school. They were going to throw them away. So just ask around. Usually family members or friends or school or even workplace, they tend to have machines that they have in a closet that they're just going to throw away. You can also just check at local flea markets or hamfests. And if you go to the hamfest, sometimes you find the machines that have already been modified. You can check Goodwill, but usually they tend to be a little bit more pricey. In restoring the machines, that's fairly simple, because since you can for free, you probably don't have to restore it, just get another one. But, I mean, that's the easiest way to go about. But, I mean, if you like messing with the hardware, you can probably find one board that has something wrong with another, and you might be able to swap something up. The versatility of the machines, you can still do a lot of stuff today with them. Bulletin board systems, you can do dial-up, and there's even a project with the Commodore 64 where they collaborated with a Linux box. Then you could have it actually telnet. I usually could telnet into the Commodore 64 running the BBS software. You can still use the Commodore 64 or the Amiga or whatever to get on the internet. If there's not a TCP/IP already for it, you can just basically find an ISP, if you're lucky, in your area that allows shell dial-up, and then you can just use the Unix or the Linux or the FreeBSD or whatever they're using. You can use that shell from there. And sometimes you can find things to do with the machines that you didn't really think didn't come right off the top of your head. At the last GameFest, I picked up a whole bunch of 8088s with, you know, 24 baud modems. And we use them around the house for various things. Dumb terminals, my mom uses hers to keep recipes on. I mean, basically, when you get bored enough, you find interesting things you can do with older machines. So basically, I mean, while you think most machines, you figure, oh, I have this, you know, 686, you know, 600 megahertz, 256 megs of RAM. You know, what do I want to do with an old Commodore 64 or Amiga or Coco? There's a lot of enjoyment in the older machines. I mean, there's just something about them because we have so much technology behind us today that certain things just aren't as impressive. You have to, I mean, when you think about when they started out, computers, they were for the companies, the big guys, and to be able to have a computer in your home that could do almost everything that the big machines could do, that was pretty impressive. And if you are a Linux or Unix fan, I'm not sure about the other machines, but I know for the Commodore 64, there's something called Linux. It's basically a Unix variant for the Commodore 64. Thinking about the two terminals, and basically it's split screen, one on top, one on bottom. I mean, with that, we have other stuff to do, so.
Okay, I guess we're going to start the Q&A now. All right, so if anyone has any questions, they can line up or, oh, you were there? Repeat that, please. Maxwell.
I don't know what that is.
I don't believe I have.
Oh, English.
Use an A4N.
I have no idea. was it like 6510 based or what? Pardon me, sir? Real? Oh.
I don't believe I've ever heard
that's,
of it.
That's one of the sad things about our little community is that we tend to be kind of, you know, centered on our own little continent and are terribly unaware of what's going on overseas. Briefly, the Commodore 64 is considered a business-class machine in Germany. IBMs were hideously expensive, so were Apple IIs, but Commodores were cheap. So it was not uncommon to see a Commodore 64 sitting on an executive's desk. And the hackers in Europe decided they wanted to do things. And one of the really cool hacks was, there's a graphic scanner for the Commodore. You know, it works. It will scan graphics. You know, one bit black and white, but it does it. And similar for the Apple II, they had the same thing. And they even had OCR for the Apple II using the hand scanner.
None
of y'all have mentioned Atari, which
are the computers that I was... Great machines!
I have a little information on Ataris in here, I believe.
The local Atari guy who has BBS wouldn't let us Apple's on it, so... I intentionally omitted Atari.
Yeah.
What would you say some of the earliest Atari PCs compared to things like the Commodore 64, which they were running directly?
I think in the gaming sense, the
Atari was superior in many ways. But true. But I don't think in some of the more business applications it was as good as the C64.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing interesting with the Atari is I remember there's a 400 model, an 800 model.
Yeah,
I think later they actually came out with a 1200 or 1600 model that was getting more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
I think the big problem was marketing and timelines.
My impression
that they came out with, I think, nice products. They were always maybe 6 months to 15 months later than what would have been desirable to get early enough market entry to get enough of the base where the games fed in, the business apps fed into it.
Right. One of the problems with 64 was it was sold in Toys R Us. You know, it was considered a toy computer.
I've heard rumors about that, and I'm not even sure. I think I know just about as much as you, but I know that there were some rumors of reviving the Amiga, but I think what they're going to do is put Smack Amiga on it and have a PC that runs some sort of Windows-like operating system. I don't think it's going to be truly an Amiga.
One thing I'd like to mention very briefly is they do have emulators now, for example, for IBM PC platforms and for other platforms to simulate almost any of these old machines.
Oh, yes.
If you want to simulate Apple II, yeah. 2 Plus, 2E, you've got module loads into all of what were the ROMs,
mm-hmm.
and you can do Apple II Plus work, run your old Apple II applets, not applets, but you run your old apps just fine mm-hmm. on a PC-class machine.
Right. Same thing with 64.
I think this is actually going to help lead towards a revival of using retro gear.
Okay, the starting point for any of this is on Usenet CompSys CBM. That is the font of all Commodore knowledge. There are people on there that know more about the Commodore than God himself because they built the damn things. Fred Bowen, an engineer, is frequently seen on CompSys CBM, as well as a few other people from the good old days of Commodore. From there, you can get, you can buy manuals. There's a place over in Finland that has just tons of stuff available for download. So if you want to start CompSys CBM, that's the place to begin.
I think we're going to take
Actually, I have multiple copies of the books. I have a book of theirs that has schematics and also tells you all the groundings and all the data. You can just come up and get them, and you can have them. So just come to the table and get them.
Going to take one more question.
Bravo, sir, bravo.
We're going to take one more question.
That's the hacker ethic, man.
IBM, auction off the IBM.
I think Yahoo search will come up pretty
fast. Plenty. Yeah, there's actually a large Cocoa emulation.
Yeah, any search engine, the Yahoo, again, CompSys CBM, they're all downloadable.
I think like campmu.org.com,
yeah.
I think that was one. They have pretty much any emulator you would need for any machine.
Cocoa emulators, they come, usually Cocoa 2 emulators. I have yet to find a freeware Cocoa 3 emulator, unfortunately. And the software you can download in plenty of places, kind of neat demos and software like that. A lot of games designers have put their websites up and are circulating their games again because it's kind of a retro computing revival going on. So I think we're going to auction off the IBM workstation.
Yeah, just briefly, I mean, okay, CompSys CBM, CompSys Atari, CompSys Apple II, CompSys whatever, you know, try that first. I mean, it's bound to be out there. You know, the Usenet is huge. There's something for everyone out there. Just look for it and you'll find it.
Okay,
go right ahead, Matt.
All right, we're going to start at $10. And this is an IBM workstation with a beautiful amber monitor and two, count them, two 5 1/4 drives.
But does it work?
It works perfectly. It has BASIC and it has some software bundle we're going to bundle with it. Do we have
$1?
No, we're starting the bidding at $10. We have
after
$10. Any?
$12.
Does anybody have 15? 15. 14? 15? Do we have 20? 20. 20. You know, it's binding. You're not getting out of this one.
Come on. Come on, man. $20. $20. Come on, let's go. 21. We've got 21.
21. Any more? Can we get to 25?
25.
30.
27.
Do we have 30? I don't think this is how you're supposed to do an auction. 30. 28. Okay, going 28. 1. 30. Okay, we're going to make this in increments of $5. There's no...
All math 35? Is now modulo 5.
Going once. 35. Any takers for 40? $40. It's a beautiful thing. Come on, 2 5-1/4 drives.
Come on, you'll sell it on eBay in 10 years for 100.
Come on. Okay, going once for 35, twice, it's sold to that guy. All right. Now we're auctioning off a Coco 2, and it's not mine, but it's got a better key. $50. Come on. $50. What if five difference does $5 make? Come on. Okay, going once for 45, twice, sold for $45. I think I have another TRS-80 Model 100 I'm going to auction off. We're going to start. It works. A few of the keys are missing, but it works fine. We're gonna. You know, you can still press the keys. It's just the things on the thing are missing.
Yeah.
I swear to God, it works. Yeah. Not mine though, and it works perfectly. You just need to buy batteries for it, and the batteries are just AA batteries.
Yeah, 4 AA batteries will run.
So, do we have $10 for $10 for the TRS-80? $15. 15?
20?
25? Who's going so well? 25? 30? 30. Who said that? You?
Over there, guy over there.
35? You can network them.
Yeah.
I swear we did it. Cheshire Catalyst.
I saw it. It's true.
It's got RS-232. So, do we have $30? $30. $35. $40. We have $40. Can we get $45 for a wonderful TRS-80 Model 100? And listen to what noise you can make on this. It's not perfect, but it works. So, do we have $50? Did we already go to $50? No, we didn't get them. $50.
$50. Wait, doesn't that thing have Excel built in? Like,
come on,
built in?
Yes. Yeah, it's got a telecom application, it's got a text editor, it's got a scheduling book, an address book, and you can take notes with it, as I do. And it's a wonderful machine, and it should go for at least $50. Do we have $50?
Welcome to Social Engineering 101. Come on.
$50.
Come on, it's worth it, trust me.
What? Do we have any questions about it so we can possibly get it up to $50 here? No, it sells for about $6.99.
How long does the battery last?
The battery lasts, actually, this battery has been running for 4 or 5 days now or something like that. No, it's not losing power either. It'll last a long time, I know that much.
Okay, as an incentive, if someone buys this laptop, I will autograph it. For
$50. Thank you. Just lost all our sales. Do we have $50? Because, I mean, people are getting restless out there. There's something going on.
In the back.
Okay. Not only will I autograph it, but Count Zero will autograph it.
We have $50. Do we have $55? Maybe I'm stretching it a little. Okay.
So,
we have once for 50, twice 50. Yeah, it sold it.
Okay.
Concludes this portion of your
broadcast.
Thank you. Pardon me? Sure. Okay, if you all could, if you want to leave, please leave out the back door, please.
Okay, we have a time machine there.
Now you're pushing it.
Thank you.
There you go, sir.
Okay, yeah.